Parenting is often lived in the extremes. It's either great joy or chaotic overwhelm. In one moment you're nailing it, and the next you're losing your cool. I want to help you find your way to the messy middle, to a place of balance. You see, balance is a verb, not a state of being. It is a thing you do, not a thing you are. It is an action, a process, a series of micro corrections that you make each and every day to keep yourself feeling centered. We are never truly balanced. We are engaged in the process of balancing. Hello, I'm Dr. Laura Froyen, and this is the Balanced Parent Podcast, where overwhelmed, stressed out, and disconnected parents go to find tools, mindset shifts, and practices to help them stop yelling at the people they love and start connecting on a deeper level, all delivered with heaping doses of grace and compassion. Join me in conversations that will help you get clear on your goals and values and start showing up in your parenting, your relationships, your life with open-hearted authenticity and balance. Let's go. Hello, everybody. On this week's episode of the Balanced Parent Podcast, we are going to be talking about ADHD, how it's diagnosed in kids, and how to get your child the support that they actually need that's going to benefit them and help them be successful and have a really fun life moving forward. So to help me with this conversation, I have Dr. Katya Fredrickson and Dr. Yael Rothman. They are two amazing neuropsychologists, and they're going to help us learn all about this. So Dr. Katya, Dr. Yael, welcome to the show. I'm so happy to have you. Dr. Katya, why don't you go first and tell us a little bit more about who you are and what you do, and then we'll go to Yael.
Absolutely. So I can sort of do a little bit for both of us because we both work at the same group practice in Maryland. It's called the Sixth Street Group. It's in Silver Spring in Maryland. And so we're both pediatric neuropsychologists, which means that we are trained in clinical psychology. We are licensed psychologists, and we have a specialty with specialized postdoctoral training in neuropsychology. And in particular for us with the pediatric population, which is sort of anything childhood through early 20s, really. And so what it means to be a neuropsychologist is that we are, when we're speaking with younger kids, we'll sort of say we're thinking doctors, right? So we sort of help kids and families figure out how the kid's brain works, what comes naturally to them, what are natural sort of areas of strength, what things might be more difficult. And so in order to do that, we administer a battery of all different kinds of tests and activities to sort of see, we look at cognitive skills, language, fine motor, attention, executive functioning, academics, socio-emotional functioning. Okay. And so we're wondering about things like, you know, always based on, of course, what the parents or teachers or whoever brings up the concern, whatever the concern is that informs our referral question. We're also just casting a broader net so that we can A, come away saying, hey, little Billy is really good at XYZ. We want to come away speaking about strengths as well as areas of concern. And we want to cast a broad net so that we are sure we can catch anything that's underlying and subtle that people may not be aware of. So we're looking at things like ADHD, learning disorders, autism, executive function difficulties, psychological anxiety, sort of vulnerabilities, those sorts of things. Yeah, sorry, I went on a bit there, but
you were great.
That's
so
essentially
good.
What we do. Okay, good.
I think
that explains it for both of us.
Do you want to tell me a little bit, Yael, about your background at all, or kind of what drew you to this field, what you're interested in, and why we're talking about ADHD specifically today?
Oh, sure. I grew up with a family of medical doctors, a lot of medical doctors in my family, and I've always been interested in physical and mental health. As I went to college, I pursued a degree in biological psychology and thought I was going to medical school, and then took a course on neuropsych. And I had never heard of this profession before, and I thought it was so fascinating. I remember hearing about the case studies and studying the brain behavior relationships, and I just really felt passionate for it. So I went on to do some research with children with different developmental differences like epilepsy or like autism, and then medical differences like epilepsy, mm-hmm. and continued to grad school. And it was just, I really love getting the chance to get to know a child so much more than other medical providers really do. We get to be with a child for 7 hours.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
My
interview Oh,
Yes,
yeah. I was
yes.
just going to say my 11-year-old went through the neuropsych eval process over this past summer. So almost a year ago now is
Oh,
when
okay.
he started in it. So I definitely sat in a neuropsychologist's office for those 7 hours. She had 2 days. She's on the autism spectrum. We had a wonderful experience with our evaluator. She loved the process, loved the tests. And so I guess maybe that's a good place to start, because I've gotten a lot of questions since. So my daughter is very open about her diagnosis. She really wants me to talk about it because she thinks it'll make it easier for other kids to talk about it, and easier for other, parents to get support if they need it. So when I started talking about it, I got a lot of emails from people asking me how we explained what was going to happen to our daughter, why we were doing it, and how we handled it in a way that ended up making it very positive for her. And I felt like you guys were the perfect people to start that conversation with. So I'm kind of thinking about the parents who are, maybe their bells are starting to ring, that maybe an eval is necessary. Maybe they've gotten that feedback from teachers or other adults in their child's lives. So how does that conversation start going with the kiddos when you decided, to call, get on the wait list, because they can be long. We were lucky, and start having that process get started for your kiddos. Do you have any tips for parents?
Of how the parents can tell their children about the
Yeah,
process that we're
yeah.
asking for. Yeah.
Yes, yeah.
I think that the conversation can often go in a positive direction when you use the child's words. I like to direct parents, like, what has your child noticed and that they're frustrated with? Oh, you know how math has been like a little harder lately? We found someone who's going to look at ways to make school a little bit easier for you. And, or you know how you've been saying how you feel really frustrated that kids aren't playing the same games you want to play all the time? Or you know how you've said blah, X, Y, Z. And I like to really pull in. And that's why we found Dr. So and so, and they're going to see how you think and learn best. And then we'll figure out ways to make this situation easier and more positive for you.
Love
So I
that.
like that, to pull in their words. I like to say that we are not medical doctors that give shots or take your temperature and things like that. So children know they're not walking into a lab, kind of, a doctor's office. It's more of a thinking doctor. You're going to do different activities that maybe you've never seen before, like puzzles, and draw some pictures and answer some questions. But Katya, do you want to add to that a little bit?
That's great. I mean, the only thing I would add is that it's a useful vehicle when the child is already participating in or has previously participated in either therapy or OT or speech, because then you can say, oh, when you go and see Miss Jen, it's going to be kind of like that. So it just normalizes the whole process. And I like how you said activities. Yeah, Elle, I like to use the word activities. I don't know. I feel like testing just sounds kind of threatening and I'm feeling anxiety provoking, and so I tend to say activities, although it does sometimes backfire, because sometimes at the end a 6-year-old will be like, well, those didn't seem like games to me, and you're like, oh, well, sorry, I think
I
you
try
should do
not to use
better.
the word games. I
Yeah,
use
you can't say
activities
games, you have to
instead.
say activities, because that they
Oh,
are
that's
not
interesting.
hoodwinked by that. Yeah, those are not games.
Yeah. My
And
11-year-old had a lot of fun. She thought they were games. So, but I can understand why maybe a 6-year-old wouldn't.
Well, a lot of kids do. A lot of kids really do. I mean, especially kids who are comfortable with adults and who are sort of curious and interested in things that are new or might be a little challenging. Or, yeah, I mean, really, kids will. And sadly, I mean, some of the kids who don't particularly like school very much, obviously that's not a good thing, but it does make them happier to come and see us because they're quite excited about getting a little break from the school day. So, yeah.
Yes. I would also tell parents if there are any concerns about their child's engagement or anxiety about kids meeting someone new, I would recommend talking to the professional about that. And sometimes, in some occasions, we schedule another day just to meet and say, hey, and here's who I am, and this is my office, and here's my shelf, and here's a book that we might be looking at together. If you really think that there's any concerns there, please tell the professional and they can come up with a nice plan too.
That's lovely. Thank you. Okay,
Yeah.
so let's hone in a little bit on ADHD. Can you tell me a little bit, like, I feel like there's
ADHD is having a moment, right? It's very big and out there. And I feel like there's maybe some misconceptions about what ADHD is, how it shows up in childhood. And so, can you talk to us, just start off from the very beginning of, what is ADHD? How is it diagnosed? Maybe how does it look maybe different in kids versus all of the adult stuff that we're seeing on TikTok these days? Can we dive in there? I
Yeah,
saw
for
a
sure.
smile on Katya's face when I mentioned
Oh,
this
yeah,
stuff on
just the reference
TikTok.
to TikTok. Oh my gosh. Yeah, I know. There's such a, I mean, there's such a wide variety of material there that is often questionable. Yeah, so not always, but often. So ADHD, and as you said, I'll start at the beginning. ADHD stands for attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. There are lots of different ways that this can look, right? So you've heard the old, if you've met one person with X, you've met one person with X. Well, this applies to ADHD as well, right? It looks very different in different people based on gender, age, just individual characteristics. But so the broad strokes are there are three sorts of things that you as a clinician are looking for as you consider this as a potential diagnosis. One is that the person in question has difficulty focusing and sustaining attention, particularly when they are being required to attend to things that are not interesting to them, that are either hard or perceived as boring, stressful, etc. Okay, so that's one piece you're looking for. You're looking for difficulty inhibiting impulses that could be observed in the person's behavior. So this is the kid who's always cutting line or, that sort of thing. Or it could be observed in their approach to tasks. So they're always rushing through their work and wanting to be the first to finish. So it can look different in different people. And the last thing you're looking for is difficulty regulating their sort of their activity level, their motoric restlessness, fidgeting, sort of always on the go, that sort of difficulty sitting still. So you're looking for some combination of those three things. And again, it's going to look different in different people, and there are different subtypes of ADHD that can encapsulate those distinctions. So there is the predominantly inattentive presentation, which refers to the kids who are more of the inattentive, distractible, daydreamy, zoned out kind of presentation. There is the predominantly hyperactive, impulsive presentation, which, yeah, Ellen, I was saying we've never actually, I at least, I've never actually diagnosed because it tends to, you died once, okay. Because
Once.
it tends to be accompanied by the attention piece as well. And then there's the combined presentation, which is all of the above, right? And so there are specific diagnostic criteria that you look at, and there are certain numbers of traits that you need to see, and you need to see them in more than one place, right? So if we have a kid who is looking quite sort of fidgety and inattentive at school, we need to also be hearing concerns about those sorts of characteristics either at home or at soccer practice or at religious service or while they're sitting with us in the office. Because if you're just seeing it in one setting, that could be something related to the setting more so than the actual individual child.
I
So
see.
just to do due diligence, and the diagnostic criteria require you to see the traits in different settings. And also, they require you to see the traits be sufficiently significant that they're impacting the person's life, right? So there is this, everybody, a lot of people say, oh, I'm so ADHD this. I'm so sort of like, oh man, I had a real ADHD moment the other day. And it's like, well, that's all well and good. And certainly I, empathize with your experience, but it's not necessarily ADHD, the, quote unquote, proper diagnosed
Like
ADHD, right?
meeting the
So that,
criteria, right? These are
yeah.
human traits. These are just human traits that some
Right.
people
On a
have extra
spectrum.
doses of.
Exactly. Exactly, on a spectrum. And so it needs to sort of surpass the level of, typical day-to-day experience for people where it's actually having a significant impact on the person's functioning. And so, you had asked about sort of how it looks different at different stages. And so we know that ADHD is associated with the development of the frontal lobe of the brain, which is developing well through our sort of mid-20s, late 20s. I feel like each time they look at it, it's longer. So yeah, right. And so as those areas of the brain develop, we hope and expect to see associated maturation when it comes to those ADHD traits. So of course, again, as we've been saying, everybody's different and you can't really take out your crystal ball and prognosticate. But that being said, I mean, often what you continue to see in adulthood is more of the higher order executive functioning vulnerability, sort of the inattentive, forgetful, disorganized, the piles of papers, the missed appointment, the late for lunch with friends, that sort of stuff. And again, I'm speaking in generalities, but this is what you may often see lingering into adulthood.
I have a question on the age thing. So a lot of what we think of with ADHD when kids are young is pretty developmentally normal, right? Not being able to maintain focus, trouble with impulse control. So can young kids be diagnosed with ADHD? Like, at what age should we start thinking about moving into an evaluation process? Because I think that lots of people get their, you know, the ping in their brain and gets on their radar at quite a young age, probably too young. What do you think?
So giving a diagnosis can happen even at very young ages, but you would see pretty extreme behaviors. Okay. If you're thinking about like a preschool student to get mm-hmm. a diagnosis, it can happen. I've never given a diagnosis to a preschool student before,
I see.
But I do know of people who have, and it was because of extreme behaviors that were happening. However, keeping an eye on behaviors, if you're hearing from the preschool teacher about things that make behavior more complicated in the classroom, if you're seeing things that make life very challenging at home, if your child is complaining about certain things, I would bring it up to people. Maybe you're a pediatrician mm-hmm. and talk about it a little bit. The answer is often to monitor and maybe put in place some supports to make life a little bit easier. Oh, here's some structured plan that could be helpful, a routine at home, if you think that mm-hmm. could be helpful for your child. But an evaluation may not be the first thing that people would recommend at that time. But I think both Katya and I really believe that if you have worries, ask. I think you don't yeah. have to keep those to asking people, asking the teacher, hey, I see this at home. Do you ever see this in your classroom? Mm-hmm. And having a conversation about that, or asking the doctor, and then and kind of writing it down. Katya always has a beautiful thing that she says, think about it in like put a note on your calendar, 4 months. Did this behavior go away that I was worried about?
Yeah.
Or has it changed? Something so to remind you, because in the moment, it's hard to see what's been going on. In the moment, all I see is how frustrating this behavior might be. But is this just today? Or is this something mm-hmm. that I'm seeing every day?
Right. Is this a phase? Right.
Or a phase? Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
And that is why most professionals, I would say, do diagnose a little bit later. There is not as many diagnoses in early childhood because behavior is so variable. I don't know mm-hmm. if anyone listening or if you have observed a preschool classroom, it's going to be so different from one child to the next.
And one day to the next.
One day to the next.
Yeah.
The kids in the classroom range from 3 to 4, and that development is so different. I love watching my own child and seeing that and experiencing that. So a lot of it is kind of monitoring and then supporting what's going on, but asking for help or questions to be answered, for sure. And some people call us just to do a consultation, just to ask a question or two, which I think many professionals would be open to as well. But Katya, would you want to add to that at all?
Well, I think that's a really thorough answer. I mean, the only thing I want to add is just, I think sometimes, and I've been guilty of this as a parent, I think sometimes we're afraid to ask the question because we're afraid of what the answer might be. Right. So we have a worry and it's almost there's this magical thinking, well, if I don't ask about it, maybe it'll just go away and nobody else will notice it and it's not a real thing. Right. And I can completely understand that. I think we've all been there at one point or another. Just again, like Yael was saying, give it some time. But if it's still there, I mean, it's really worth following up on because the more you wait and see and wait and see and wait and see, you know, you may miss out on some windows when it would have been really useful to put intervention or supports mm-hmm. of some sort in place. So okay. I would just, you know, try to ask the question.
I really love that. I love this very specific recommendation too of putting a note in your calendar 4 months ahead to kind of check back in. I really love using our modern tools and technology can sometimes take things away from us in our parenting, but this is a time where it can really add to us, mm-hmm. you know, be a benefit for us. I really love that suggestion. I love that kind of wait and see, but with intention and consciousness approach, as opposed to just kind of waiting and seeing and ignoring. I think it's hard for mm-hmm. parents when they're getting feedback from an adult or they're, you know, in their child's life, like a teacher, or they're seeing things. I think it's really hard for the average parent to piece out, okay, so what is typical developmentally appropriate stuff and what is extra, what is more than what's developmentally appropriate. And I feel like there's not a lot of confidence in like, okay, so when do we actually need to make that decision to go and get support? Do you have any tips for parents who are in that place?
Well, I mean, I think, so I tend to think, well, A, speaking to the teacher, right? Because the teacher is in the exact perfect position to compare the child to children of their same age, mm-hmm. not just in that classroom, but in the years of previous classrooms the teacher has had, right? So I think the teacher is a wonderful resource. And I would also, I mean, I would go to the pediatrician because you can just set up a consult, check in with the pediatrician, say, hey, these are my concerns. And they'll give you a standardized questionnaire to fill out. And then they can score that questionnaire. And again, it will compare the way you rate your child at that age to the way other parents rate their child at that age. And so that'll give you an idea of whether something is, quote unquote, normal or not.
And we talk a lot about how parents really know their child the best out of anyone, right? So trust yourself and ask for help if you really feel like something is not quite right. And if a professional tells you, hey, actually, that's a behavior that we commonly see in development, how awesome that you sought out that and got that answer. And that's great. And that's still really good to find out. It is really hard to piece apart, especially in early development, what is development typical and what isn't, because they overlap completely. Yeah. A lot of behaviors in developmental diagnoses like autism, ADHD, do have very typical beginnings. We expect children to have repetitive motor mannerisms as toddlers. Like that is something that is commonly seen in little ones. But as you get older, you don't see that, right? So these are rooted in typical behaviors that become atypical as time goes on.
Yes. Yeah. Like my 11-year-old, when she was around 4, she became obsessed with dragons. And she was a dragon most of the time from 4 to 6. And that was fine from 4 to 6. And then she continued to be a dragon through 7 and 8. And then it started causing social problems, you know, and those are things that, you know, like something that started out, you know, very, very developmentally typical, you know, and her special interests have moved on past dragons. Now she's got Taylor Swift going, which again is, you know, not a problem for her. She's, you know, I see what you're saying, that those things can, you just have to keep an eye on them. Can I ask you, so kind of on the flip side, there, a lot of parents feel worried about getting a label or a diagnosis for their kid. They feel worried about getting their kid pigeonholed in a certain way. They feel worried about some kind of stigma. And I'm curious about what you would have to say around what are some of the benefits for getting your kid evaluated and possibly diagnosed, especially when we're talking about ADHD. What does it give access to for your child? What kind of supports does it allow parents and their teachers to give to a child? What are the benefits?
Yeah. So I would first step back and as a parent, try to figure out where the worry is coming from, from you. So a lot of times parents come to us with a worry that if I give a label to my child, it will make them feel less than or lack self-confidence, feel different. Unfortunately, what happens is, so first of all, children are more self-aware than we give them credit for.
Yes.
So I think everyone should be thinking about that, that kids, if you think something's not going quite right, the child knows that something is not going quite right. Mm. But when we don't have a word or understanding of why something isn't working out for us, we often will go to a negative self-attribution. Yes. And so a child could be, oh, kids don't want to play with me. I must be stupid. I must be weird. I must be a problem. I can't do math the same way that my classmates can. I must not, I'm never going to know anything. So something negative can go into their head. So instead, we could give them this idea, this profile. Hey, actually, you're a really bright kid who knows so many things. And this is one thing that's a little harder for you, but we know how to help you. So that would change. It's not, instead of giving the poor self-esteem, it would actually increase your self-esteem, make you a better advocate for yourself, help connect you to other people and understand how your brain works and thinks best. So if that's where the worry is coming from, instead, it would actually be a more positive label than the one that they probably are thinking about themselves in those moments when they have no understanding.
Gosh,
Another worry.
I just really I just really love that reframe. I think our kids are going to make sense of what's happening to them in the world around them, and having that as something that helps them make sense of it, having it kind of an informed perspective to come from, is really beautiful. So thank you for sharing that.
Definitely. And all of these worries are so understandable. I mean, and expected. I mean, these are your children. You want to protect them and support them. Sometimes parents also might have worries from when they had a diagnosis as a child, which does happen a lot. We know these are genetic components. There are genetic components in these diagnoses. But we've come a long way. The stigma has reduced over time. We understand how brains work better. We understand interventions and supports better. So their experience might be, I am expecting, will be quite different than their child's experience will be with this diagnosis. So that's another thing. So what are the benefits for a child to hear about their diagnosis are just what I mentioned before. It's to empower them. We want children to understand, here's how I think and learn best, and then be able over their lifetime to advocate for those needs. Hey, I do really well when I get to sit in the front row. Is that okay? Mm-hmm. Is that where I can be today? Or I really am going to need to write this down or take a picture of the board if I need to remember what we're going to talk about today. So I'm going to need that accommodation. And it helps them as they move through life to become their best self advocates and feel empowered and learn about the gifts that come along. The diagnosis as well. And we can talk about those in a little bit, but it's not all challenges when you're a different thinker. It also is some beautiful gifts that can be attributed to the diagnosis as well.
Ooh, I would love to hear what some of those are.
Sure. Should I keep going, or Katya, do you want to take a
I'll jump in and you can take a breath.
Sorry.
No, I know I can go on. We both
I know, me too. Oh my God. We are chatterboxes, man.
It's so fun to hear people geek out on a topic that they love. So it's good.
Oh, yeah, totally. Oh my gosh, geek kingdom here. Yes. Well, strengths, yes, but there was one other thing you had asked about. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you want to continue with strengths or go back to that, but you asked about like access to services and that, I mean, that sort of benefit that is conferred diagnosis. Which direction do you want to go in?
Let's go with the access to services and supports, and then we'll go into positive attributes.
Yeah. Well, so that's a secondary piece. So the first, there's the child's just personal insight and understanding and sense of self-worth and the parent's insight and understanding, right? And I think so important for many parents is this idea of distinguishing between what a child is not yet developmentally ready to do versus something the child is choosing not to do in order to be aggravating to the parent, right? So we refer to it as the can't do versus the won't do, right? Mm-hmm. And so an aspect of that's very helpful with diagnosis is helping parents it really sort of helps parents understand, oh, wow, there are certain things that, you know, my kid may just not be ready for yet. I may need to sort of modify this demand, put more sort of structure, scaffolding in place, et cetera. And that will create a less frustrating experience for everyone in the house, right? So for the children and the parents' knowledge and benefit, but then also as regards services at school, for example. So it really varies from school to school, whether they're independent, whether they're public, whether they're in this district or that. I mean, it doesn't matter. It just varies from school to school. There's no hard and firm rule. But so some schools will offer accommodations informally. So we come across that a lot in the course of our work where parents will come in and say that the kid is already receiving some sort of accommodations like preferential seating or access mm-hmm. to headphones or whatever it is, something, but nothing has been formally documented. And so in some cases that may be adequate, in other cases it may not be. And again, it's a very case by case sort of situation. But so in general, though, the idea is that in order to trigger essentially the special education laws, your child needs to have a formal diagnosis. Mm-hmm. And you use that as a platform, or the evaluator or whoever, pediatrician or whoever clinician uses that as a platform to request specific interventions or supports, accommodations for the child at school. And so, you know, you alluded to the IEP. So there's the 504, which is the accommodation plan, which means that the academic instruction, the curriculum, things are being delivered. It's the same content, but there may be a difference in the method of delivery or the way the child is treated, or in other words, where they can sit and, you know, they can have the fidget or they can have extra time, those sorts of things, but it's the same content. And, or there is the heavier duty IEP, which refers to when a child is being given a direct service of some sort or another at school. So it's, you know, some sort of pull out for learning support or push in for learning support, for speech, for OT, for counseling, whatever it is. Okay. Or there could be, you know, obviously you can, well, not obviously, but you can also access these sorts of plans via medical disabilities. So there may be some physical sort of gross motor, or maybe something else that the child needs support with that will also access you those sorts of plans. But so that's the other, another reason why it's useful when there is a diagnosis to call it what it is and to spell it out, because then you can, the child has certain legal rights based on that diagnosis.
Yeah. And so I feel curious, I guess I do want to talk about kind of the positive attributes of ADHD, the gifts that come along with the diagnosis. But I feel curious about, and something that parents who have a kid with an ADHD diagnosis struggle with, is what does that actually mean for their kids' functioning and how to make accommodations, how to shift things. And I know that they will, you know, everybody, you know, like you said, their ADHD is very individual and very, you know, the approach needs to be tailored to the kiddo that has the ADHD. But what are some of the general things that kids might struggle with? Let's say, let's just keep it, you know, let's let school be school. Let's just keep it at home. How might my ADHD struggles show up at home? And what are some of the things that parents can be thinking about at home to support their kids?
You want to do struggles, Yael, and I'll do interventions, or vice versa?
I was thinking, yeah, we can keep adding to each other.
Okay, go ahead.
I was thinking about how these can, again, they'll look different from one person to the next. Mm-hmm. Let's say it's about following directions, and that's really hard to keep all of these directions in mind. One thing that we often preach is about making things more visual, writing things down, having routines and structure at home in the written form. I've had fun conversations with families about how a young child spends 30 minutes in the shower, but never uses soap, right? They're just playing in the shower and enjoying and daydreaming and feeling the water on them. And then they put a laminated schedule in the shower that says, first you wash your hair, then you wash your, whatever it is, a whole list of body parts that are going to be washed. And that child had more independence there, instead of the parent opening the door and yelling, did you wash your hair yet? Did you do this yet? Did you do that yet? It now was a checklist that was there for the child to get to know and gradually get comfortable with. Katya, I realize I'm saying an intervention as well. Sorry.
Bye. Oh my goodness. Speaking of following instructions.
It's true. I'll need that support too.
Speaking of following instructions.
But structure and routines and visual schedules are great for all kids. A lot of kids do really well with these, and can be really nice interventions for children who are struggling with you repeating yourself over and over again at home about following an instruction, making this like the morning routine as well. You can print it on the mirror. And again, this gives the young person more independence. So it's not the parent constantly reminding, they can go through it eventually on their own. And you can do this with everything. Packing the bag can have a little visual schedule. Making a lunch can have a little routine for that. And that can be a really nice piece there.
Right. Because it increases independence, which in turn increases self-confidence.
Yes.
And also is increases the parents, or decreases the parents' blood pressure, I guess. So it's positive all around. Yeah. And we also, so there are various sorts of, you know, we often talk to parents about strategies to use at home. And so that's a big one, is the visuals. We talk to parents about health behaviors, about sort of maximizing sleep. We talk about sort of what the National Sleep Foundation and these sorts of places, there are set, well, a range of sort of hours recommended for each age range, so that, and, you know, obviously they're going to be outliers, but just it gives you a gross idea of, you know, elementary school age children, 9 to 11 hours nightly are recommended. So it gives you sort of a gross idea of, okay, so if we have, if I want bedtime, so Jimmy has to get up for school at 6:30 or whatever. So I want bedtime to be 8:30 maybe. So then I can count back and figure out, well, I have to start the routine at this time and we have to eat dinner at this time, and so you can sort of work that out. And so we really encourage the sleep is a huge component for so many things, ADHD included, and so tough these days with the screens and the phones and all this business. So we talk a lot with parents about sleep hygiene, about getting just the basic common sense stuff, getting some sort of regular physical activity, common sense nutrition and hydration. So those sorts of things are very important as well for, things that parents can work on at home.
Can you talk to me for a second about screen usage and kiddos with ADHD? Are kiddo like I feel like there is this kind of sense out there that kiddos who have ADHD are more drawn to screens, and I'm kind of curious about that. Do you know any of the research or data to support that or why that might be?
One of the things that can be a gift along with ADHD and also can be a complication is a tendency to hyperfocus on areas of interests, which is really fascinating because you don't think about that in ADHD. You think more of the attention deficit versus the attention hyperfocus. And screens are a very common one in the population. I do think there was some research showing that there was a higher use of screens in ADHD. However, it's probably coming from a lot of different reasons. Some being family life, like we parents who might be dealing with a child who needs more attention for their hyperactivity and impulsivity might need those moments to get things done and have that screen time. So it might be an important thing for some family systems to get by. I think that it can also be, just a very strong area of interest for most children right now, a social piece as well that goes along in it here too. When we get concerned, I think, about the use of screens is really when it's getting in the way of other activities being completed. So we don't say, I don't think I've ever said, like, you have to remove every screen. I've never given that recommendation. It can often even be a soothing technique for some that I have quiet time at the end of my day. But if your child is using screens so much that they're not able to do other activities, they're missing out on different activities, that's something to now reassess and understand and to make sure it's not impacting sleep. That we would recommend, just as Katya was saying before about sleep hygiene, that screens not be used before bedtime because it can actually activate us instead of get us tired. So are probably the main things we'd think about with screens, unless you wanted to add anything to that, Katya.
No, and I mean, we often talk to families, when kids are a bit older and have their own phones or iPads or whatever, we tend to recommend that those not be in the bedroom at night, right? And I have had, very sort of rigid teenagers who have really rebelled against that recommendation, and parents have said, "Well, she says that her friends might have an emergency and they might need to contact her in the night, and her friends have blah blah blah, and she just won't let go of that phone." And I always say, "Well, tell her to just give the friend the do you have a landline? Tell her to give the friend the landline number if it's really an emergency. Surely you won't mind the friend." No, I mean, then it will only be an emergency under which circumstance contact the house. I mean, so I feel like kids have very strong feelings about this, and you really need to sort of think through, okay, is there a way I can reassure you to get you on board with this so I don't have to battle with you on it every night without sort of giving up, without over accommodating you and giving up on what I think is an important thing for your well-being, right?
I think too, for those of us who have younger kids starting now with ourselves, like keeping screens and phones out of our bedrooms ourselves is probably good. Right. So modeling that ourselves so that when the kids do get phones in the future, they already know that everyone leaves their phones in the kitchen, mom and dad included, is a good
It's
idea.
good to model the behavior. I mean, it's so hard, but we do need to try to practice what we preach, right? I think,
And another thing that screens don't have to be the enemy. They can be a helpful tool that these individuals support. As a child becomes an adolescent, it actually there can be really cool apps to help with scheduling and organizing and different things and can use these to be beneficial for everyone as well, I think can be helpful.
Yeah, you can mm-hmm. use them to offload some of that executive functioning.
Mm-hmm, for sure.
Yeah, beautiful. Yeah. Okay, so you mentioned, Yael, the kind of hyper-focus. What are some of the other positives, some benefits to having ADHD?
So research has actually shown that individuals with ADHD are more creative than individuals without ADHD, more out-of-the-box thinkers. And that's really interesting and awesome. And you can see there's a high proportion of a high number of CEOs who have ADHD, which you think about people who have created and come up with an idea and then started a business about it. So that's really cool. Some things like being spontaneous, it can be a beautiful asset at many times. And that's something that goes along. Risk taker, there can definitely be some beautiful things that being a risk taker can support in your life. And being really interested in a topic, hyper-focusing can actually lend itself towards different careers later on. I think there's been some famous athletes who have talked about how being hyper-focused because of their ADHD on their sport lend themselves to become, you know, in the Olympics. And it's a really cool trait as well.
Katie or Katya, did you have anything to add?
No, I was just thinking about just the benefits of the hyperfocus. I mean, again, it sounds like a bad thing, hyperfocus, like it just sounds like a negative term. And it can be when you're trying to get your kid transitioned off something.
You know, I was going to say that transitions can be really difficult when a kid is in their hyperfocus.
Transitions can be hard.
Yeah.
But it's so often things, there are two sides of a coin, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, so energy level. Sometimes I just chuckle watching the kids in the waiting room at the office or watching my own kids and thinking, my goodness, I wish I could bottle your energy and sell it and I would be a gazillionaire. A
millionaire. Yeah. You know?
But like, I mean, all these things, they have their side, which can be more difficult to manage. And then they have a side that's actually really quite positive. It just needs to be directed properly.
Great. Okay. And so one of the other things that I wanted to make sure that we talked about is the differences in boys and girls and how ADHD presents and why we seem to be missing ADHD in girls so much.
We need like a wink. We need a
you need a signal.
Yeah. So yeah, because they can't see this. If we look like make weird winks, nobody can tell. So, right. So this is one of those, you used the word earlier, Laura, misconception. I mean, right. So there are lots of misconceptions out there about ADHD. And one is essentially that it's like a boy's issue, that girls don't have ADHD. And that misconception arises from the fact that, again, speaking in general, girls tend to present more frequently with that inattentive presentation mm-hmm. that we discussed earlier, which is more subtle. It's less readily evident. So if you imagine yourself as a teacher sitting in a classroom with 30 kids, and there's the one kid who's sort of sitting on the side, quietly doodling or looking out the window or just, you know, just seeming to be a lot, that person will not catch your attention. It's really going to be the kids who are, there's some sort of behavioral manifestation who are going to be more readily observed, right?
Yeah.
So that can happen at home too, right? I mean, so same sort of principle in all sorts of different settings where these girls can just slip under the radar. And again, I am speaking in generality. So there's certainly boys for whom we use a predominantly inattentive presentation diagnosis subtitle or subtype. But just again, speaking in generalities, that's often the case for girls. And so it can lead to a situation where very often these girls are quite bright. They want to do well. They manage to sort of mask either intentionally or unintentionally. These symptoms are masked when they're younger. And then they, at some point or another, though, most kids will start to hit some sort of wall as the difficulty level rises, the level of output demands and complexity rises. So middle school, high school, college, in adulthood, women will get diagnosed with ADHD. And I mean, it was there all along. It just wasn't, people weren't aware of it as much. And so that's one of the reasons why sort of rates of ADHD diagnosis have increased over time, is that we've gotten better at noticing these kids. And it's important to do so because even though the repercussions may not be obvious, there are repercussions. There are effects on learning, there are effects on emotional well-being, social functioning. And so it's really important to catch these kids so that we can give them the supports they need.
Yeah, there's even studies that tie, you know, ADHD to differences in lifespan too. So the range is between 7 to 10 years of shortened lifespan for undiagnosed ADHD, which is really interesting to think about. Like that is a, you know, that's something, sorry, untreated ADHD, not undiagnosed. It's something that in any other diagnosis, we would not.
Right. Would be a big deal.
It would be a big deal. You know, yes.
It would be a big deal. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and when you allude to, I mean, you mentioned untreated. I mean, so one thing we haven't mentioned is medication, right? Mm-hmm. So that's a first year treatment recommendation that we make to families. So there are lots of things that can be done at school, that can be done at home in terms of parenting strategies, health behaviors, et cetera, accommodations. And then we always recommend learning about and, you know, learning about medication.
Well, because lots of parents that are really nervous about that.
Mm-hmm, for sure. Oh, for sure. We have that conversation all the time. I mean, and so we're not MDs. We're not medical doctors. We don't prescribe, but we do know a fair amount about it just based on our experience and training and so forth. And yeah, it's scary. It's scary to medicate your child, for sure, for sure. And, you know, so parents, rightly so, have lots of questions about it and the efficacy and the safety, et cetera. And I mean, fortunately, we're able to tell them the stimulant medication, which is the first order medication used in the treatment of ADHD, has been used with children, I think, since the 60s, right? I mean, it's been around for a long time. So there's a lot of long-term research on the safety and efficacy of the medication. So we can really point to some good data, which is not always the case with medications that are used with children. Very often, it just gets piggybacked onto adult research.
Yeah.
Right. And so with this one, there's a lot of long-term, and there's a lot of sort of long-term data that you can point to. And yeah, so I totally understand that it's scary. I mean, the other thing I always point out to parents too, is that really it's something that is in and out of the bloodstream in the course of a day.
Yeah.
So it's not like one of these medications, like if your child is taking an SSRI, like an anxiety or depressive, you know, it's like a Prozac or whatever it is, where you have to work up to a therapeutic level and you have to be at that level for a certain amount of time before you see an effect, et cetera, et cetera. It's really just, you will see what you will see over the course of that day. And if there is something that you really don't like or your child is not comfortable with, you are not obligated to readminister the medication the next day. So I think having that feeling of control, and we will say, I mean, oftentimes it is trial and error. The first thing will not always fit. And so, you know, if you see something you don't like, that's fine. That's okay. That's normal. You know, your doctor can prescribe you another one to try. It's just everybody is different and everybody, one size does not fit all, right?
Yeah.
So I think that having that control over it helps parents feel more comfortable. The more informed we are and the more control we have when we're doing an intervention like that with our child, I think it really helps us feel more comfortable.
Yeah. And do you recommend that parents take their kids to see a child psychiatrist to get medication prescribed, or is your family doctor or pediatrician an appropriate place to go?
It's a great question. Almost all pediatricians, all the ones I've ever worked with, are very comfortable with the class of stimulant medications. Mm-hmm. So that could be a totally great place to begin. I would say psychiatrists are also very comfortable with this. They are special. The pediatrician is more of a generalist. So if you are comfortable with your pediatrician, you feel like this is someone who knows you and understands you, I think that would be a great place to begin. Mm-hmm. If you would feel better seeing someone who only sees individuals who have differences and who need medication versus the pediatrician who sees probably mostly well visits kids who are doing pretty development, who are developmentally typical. So that would be the difference. Psychiatrists often, at least in our area, are hard to get into and see, and they can have long wait lists and sometimes don't take insurance. So that often will push family to see their pediatrician, who again is usually very well versed. Right.
Yeah, I tend to think it's best, you know, provided you're comfortable and you like your pediatrician, although you wouldn't continue to see them otherwise.
I hope not.
If that were the case, you would. Yeah. So I would start with your pediatrician and more, I think of, I would send someone directly to a child psychiatrist or adolescent psychiatrist, more if it's a very sort of a complicated picture, like there are multiple things going on. Yes. Maybe the child is depressed and they have ADHD, and, you know, there's just more of a complicated picture and we just want to be absolutely sure we're crossing our T's and dotting our I's. Mm-hmm. But if we're looking at ADHD on its own, I always just say head off to the pediatrician. It's much easier and more cost-effective, and time-wise, much more efficient.
Okay. And I know here in the US and in Canada, there have been some shortages around ADHD medications. Is that ongoing and is that affecting kids?
It is ongoing and it's no fun.
I'm sure it's not.
Oh yeah, it is ongoing. And so, yeah, it's just so hard because everybody is so busy in their lives and it's just an added stressor. It's an added demand. And you will find yourself in certain months, like on the phone. I mean, I have one of my daughters has ADHD and is medicated. And I have like a post-it on my laptop with all the local pharmacies and their numbers. And there were months when I would just be going down that list, call, 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 call. And there were months when we needed to change her medication to accommodate what was available. And it's very frustrating, but you know, it's just one of those situations where you just have to do the best you can under the circumstances. But yeah, it's hard and it's ongoing, but it does seem to wax and wane. So certain medications that were once difficult to get are now, so it just seems to see. Yeah. So it can be easy one month, hard the next month, just unpredictable.
Okay. Have you seen any changes in families being able to get the diagnosis or resistance within other fields to accept that diagnosis? Cause I feel like there is a kind of a vibe in the air that ADHD is being overdiagnosed all of a sudden. And I highly doubt that that's the case, but I do think that I've heard from some parents that some doctors are skeptical of ADHD diagnoses coming in. I'm curious if that's something you've experienced and how parents can kind of deal with some of that skepticism around perhaps it being overdiagnosed.
I think that this is coming from a few different places. One is that there are more diagnoses over time because we become more aware and better understanding of these more subtle presentations, the more inattentive presentations. And so it is becoming more accurate that way, that we are, the diagnoses we missed, we're getting better at spotting.
Yeah.
We are evidence-based practitioners. We follow the guidelines, and you have to talk to multiple sources to see if symptoms present in different settings. And we are lucky to work amongst people who would do the same. If there is a professional who is just saying yes to everybody who walks in their door and saying, yes, that's ADHD, ADHD, without doing any sort of question to different sources or finding sure that all criteria are met, then we'd have a problem with that. And I question these doctors who are skeptical. Where are they coming from? What are they skeptical about? Mm-hmm. Is it that they are saying, oh, this child is so smart, so it can't be ADHD? Hey, that's true, right? And let's talk about that. Actually,
and kind of ableist. Yes.
Yeah. So I would just question the provider and say, what is it about this diagnosis that I just got from a professional that you are skeptical about?
Okay.
And then find out a little bit more. Maybe it is that they don't realize that ADHD can present in these more subtle ways or look a little different in female or something. And because we all have, things we don't know completely about
Okay. So is there anything else that you guys would like to share with my audience about the ADHD process? I know you have a book out for kids, Introducing ADHD to Children, right?
Right. Yeah. We, as part of our work, part of the process is guiding parents toward resources, right? And so parents will often ask us or we will just proactively provide resources so that parents can learn more about, their child's how their child's brain works and how we talked earlier about the importance of children understanding their own diagnoses. And so we also like to provide resources that will help parents with that journey, right? And so we keep a pretty close finger on the pulse of what's available in terms of the resources that are out there. And we're consistently finding a hole in the literature. When it came to books that will specifically lay out a diagnosis in a developmentally appropriate and visually appealing manner, and that has a good balance of concerns versus strengths and different ways in which the diagnosis can present, et cetera, et cetera. And so we were having trouble finding that sort of resource. And it's really something that I think a lot of parents really wanted. And so we decided to create it. It was a COVID project when we were needing our brains to get a little exercise. Yeah. And so we wrote this book and we got this lovely publisher and this great illustrator who we think the world of. And the idea is that it presents ADHD diagnosis for an elementary school age population. And it's a book that a parent could read with a child or a teacher or a therapist or a grandparent or whoever to help walk them through the process. And it's an interactive books so that I don't mean it has flaps. That would be cool though. Questions and sort of discuss. I love flap books when the kids were younger. Oh my gosh. Anyway, it has questions and, you know, so and so has this issue. Has this ever happened to you? Or, you know, so it's supposed to be an engaging sort of vehicle for conversation. So it presents three, the book presents a brief description of neurological development, again, highly visual and sort of developmentally appropriate level of discussion. Three vignettes of different ways in which ADHD can present, because of course we have discussed the many different ways in which ADHD can present. So we're trying to sort of hit the main bases, sort of what that means. Fun facts, strengths, things that can be done to help with the things that are harder, and a workbook to sort of go through and individualize the book for the child. Yeah, and so we've got a couple more in the pipeline, but we want to start with ADHD because that's such a big one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I will say that I read the book with my daughter who's 8, almost 9, and for whom ADHD bells ring for me. And so it was fun to read through that. And she's like, oh, that's kind of like me. Oh, mom, that's a little bit like me. And it was just interesting. And so, I mean, and we talked and I was like, well, and is that something that you would want to, go and talk with someone who, knows how kids think? And then she's like, no, it's a problem yet, but if we need it, sure. So it was a very lovely book just to like proactively have with for my kiddo too, which was really nice.
Smart. Oh yeah, and we've totally had friends and who have read the book with their kids who there's no suspicion of ADHD, and the kids have, oh wow, yeah, that makes me think of so and so in my class, and maybe that's
Yes,
why they have trouble with blah blah or whatever, you know. And so that was not our direct intention, but such a nice sort of vehicle for explaining neurodiversity to kids.
and acceptance, not just acceptance, but affirmation too. So both my girls go to a very neurodiverse school, and lots of their kids are kind of out and proud with their ADHD and autism diagnoses. And so, yes, reading it, my daughter's like, ooh, that's like my friend. And oh, this is kind of like my other friend, and that's why my this friend needs fidgets. And I mean, it's a lovely book. Thank you for putting it out in the
Oh,
world.
thanks. Gosh,
Thank
thank
you so
you.
much.
Thank you. We appreciate your feedback and love to hear that you read it with your daughter.
Oh, I think it's like so important for parents to have access to those books, that they can share with their kids. Even if they're like, again, like even if things aren't on their radar, it's one of the perks of my job when I get to have amazing guests and authors on the show. I get to have those books in my house. And I love that my kids get to have access to diversity in that way. So I really appreciate that so much.
Oh, well, we're glad to, happy to help. Yeah,
You
I
are
mean, that's
helping.
the, well, that's the, like you were saying, having the books in the house. I mean, that's part of the idea of this is just to make it more accessible. I mean, we love our work and think it's a really useful thing to do, but also we know it's not accessible for everyone. There's going to be a neuropsychologist hanging out on every corner who you can get in to see in a time efficient manner. And so the idea of the book is just to put it out there in a cost effective and accessible means, right?
Yeah, well, we really appreciate it. And I know you also do a lot of work on social media. So, where can our listeners find and connect with you and learn from you?
Thank you so much. Yeah, we are also trying to make it evidence-based information accessible to individuals. So you could go to our website, which is Neuropsych Moms. You can also follow us on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. Again, Neuropsych Moms. And psych, as people know, PSY. So Neuropsych Moms.
Wait, is it
Yeah, it's
Neuropsych
not easy
Moms
to
or is
spell.
it Neuropsych Mom Docs?
Thank you so much. We recently
You
have
just changed it.
changed it. So it,
Okay, right,
yes. So
good.
we dropped the docs, hoping to make it a little easier, but it's still a little complicated.
Yeah,
Yes.
it was clunky. It was clunky, but you know, what can you do?
Okay, so
Yeah.
Neuropsych Moms. Yes. Okay, good. Well, I hope everyone will go and give you a follow. And I also appreciate you joining me on the show. And I hope you'll keep me posted as more books come out.
Oh, for sure. Thank you for having us. We really appreciate it. It's like what you said, geeking out. We love just sitting
Yes.
and chatting about all this. So much fun.
Well, thank you so much.
Okay, so thanks for listening today. Remember to subscribe to the podcast, and if it was helpful, leave me a review. That really helps others find the podcast and join us in this really important work of creating a parenthood that we don't have to escape from and creating a childhood for our kids that they don't have to recover from.
And if you're listening, grab a screenshot and tag me on Instagram so that I can give you a shout out. And definitely go follow me on Instagram. I'm at Laura Froyen, PhD. That's where you can get a behind the scenes look at what balanced conscious parenting looks like in action with my family. And plus I share a lot of other really great resources there too. All right, that's it for me today. I hope that you keep taking really good care of your kids and your family and each other, and most importantly, of yourself. And just remember, balance is a verb, and you're already doing it. You've got this.